On this episode of Still Loading, we get digitally distracted. Hey guys, it's Josh, and welcome back to this new episode of Still Loading. Alright, so often now as I find myself, I know I'm not old, but as I get up there in age, I find it harder for me to find entertainment of any sort that I actually enjoy watching, listening, participating in, anything of that nature. And so I'm very, I don't want to say stuck in my ways, but at the same time it is hard for me to find things that I really can latch on to. I usually am a like, oh, that's cool, and then I move on. So it's very rare for me to find a channel or any type of entertainment that I really like can sink my teeth into. And today, my guest has created a channel just as such as that. So for this week's episode, I am interviewing Game Dave. Say hello, sir.
Well, hello. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate the very intense shout out there. That's good. That's good.
No, thank you. Seriously, thank you for coming on this. I am a huge fan, even though I haven't watched all of your stuff. There's a lot of content out there since you're a very busy person.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so let's just dive right into it. So the first thing, for everyone listening who may not have seen your channel, how would you describe your channel to those who have never seen it?
It's always a tough question because I sort of have a lot of things on the channel and a lot of things that have been on the channel over time. The easiest way would be to say, oh, it's an online web show with a focus on video games. But I would say that in a way, the video games are kind of a supporting role. Mm-hmm. Because my real goal is to just entertain people and, you know, put a smile on your face with whatever I talk about. And then, I sort of use my interest and hobby and passion for video games to sort of create a format for that. But I would say it's kind of a mix of, you know, gaming reviews, both vintage and new, talk shows recently with the new Digitally Distracted talk show, which is now coming to a podcast form here. And there's also some storyline fiction things and skits, and it's kind of all over the place, and a little bit of import gaming as well.
All right. I mean, the way I always kind of saw it as well is that you're kind of like the Pixar of video games, if that makes sense.
Okay.
High production quality, kind of like that. You have that line that kind of skirts the. You have jokes that kind of skirt that line where some of them are just a little bit above the kids' heads, but at the same time, they're so innocuous if you don't know what they are, type of thing.
Yeah. I go for that nice. I'd say a hard PG or an 80s PG maybe.
That's a good way to describe it. I like it. All right, so then with that in mind, what made you want to start creating content on YouTube?
So I actually started long ago in when YouTube first kind of came around. I was in college already, and I had been in video production. I went to a tech school in high school, so I did a shop, and my shop was, you know, radio, TV, film production. So I learned on the very early versions of Premiere. So this was like before Premiere was pro. So it was a little bit more.
I think I know exactly what you're talking about. I think I was just a little bit later. My high school had a similar thing, but with Premiere Pro.
And so that's where I kind of learned nonlinear editing and some, you know, the basics of video production, because I always had an interest in being an entertainer or being in film and making movies, and that was a really good thing to, you know, sort of get my feet wet with. And after high school, I got into college. I wasn't going to college for video production, but I was still making movies. And I think it was either 2005 or 2006. I believe 2006 would have been my second semester of my freshman year. A friend of mine had mentioned this YouTube thing, and it was very new. It wasn't quite, I don't know if it was at the point where the videos would just pop up and then slide across as people uploaded them because it was so small. I think it may have been at that point, or it may have been at the point where they had just made sort of this channel setup, and it was very similar to kind of like MySpace. It almost looked like early MySpace, where you could change the colors of your channel page, and you know, a lot of people had very ugly YouTube channels back then.
Would you do any of your own coding for it? Like, would you do like the HTML or CSS code for it? Or
if I did any, it was super basic. I'm pretty much just changed the colors, because at that time I wasn't thinking about branding, because I didn't see YouTube as, oh, this is the new online video platform. I just made an account. Like, I didn't even call it a YouTube channel. It's like, oh yeah, I made a YouTube account, and I just uploaded this very old Lego stop motion animation I made way back in high school.
What? That's awesome.
Called The Kingdom, and it was just super cheesy, and I'm doing all the voices, and so that was the very first video I uploaded in 2006, and it was already an old video when I uploaded it in 2006, so you can imagine. I mean, I think I made it maybe junior year in high school, so this would have been, that's like 2002 maybe, so it was pretty intense. I made it in my parents' house, in my bedroom, on top of this like this chest that had Legos in it, so it was like very basic, but I just put that up there just as a test, really, of this YouTube thing, and then forgot about it, and then kind of came back several months later and sort of started tinkering more with it.
All right. I can relate to that. I always kind of felt the draw to be an entertainer, but I was always too shy about it. I guess that's why I kind of do podcasts, because people can't see me. My younger brother, he actually went to college for acting. He went to school for musical theater, so he's like the actor of the family. But ever since we were kids, both of us would always want to perform. I remember I wish we would have filmed it, and then I would have put something like that up on YouTube. But we had this thing called a playroom, quote unquote. So it was just a separate room to the house where all our toys are at, and that's where we would play. Mm-hmm. And I remember we had a record player, and we were obsessed with the Monkees. And I don't know why. and we would literally put on lip sync concerts for the neighbors. They would come over, and we would just jump up and down on the sofa and lip sync to the Monkees, like me and the neighbor kids, and then our parents would watch. It's so embarrassing thinking about it now.
Well, it's funny because that's basically what early YouTube was, a lot of people doing lip sync videos.
Yeah, it was. There was a either that or trying to. I feel really judgmental saying this, but either trying to become a singer and really should not be singing.
I'll tell you, like I've gotten, you know, over the years, I did a lot of theater. I did a lot of you know, acting stuff as a kid and as I got older. But I will say that that's like the one thing that has always been tricky for me. Like, I don't get awkward and nervous the way I used to, you know, going on stage or being in front of people. But singing in front of people is such a different thing to do. Like, that's like just putting yourself out there, and that's something that would still make me nervous.
Well, I don't blame you. I mean, I feel like with singing especially, that is a lot more, like, if when you act in front of people, you can craft the character to your strengths. So mm-hmm. you could easily make a character that something you're comfortable with doing. You can make an exaggerated version of yourself, so right. that way it makes it 10 times easier to behave that way in front of people. But when you sing, if you don't have a good tone of voice, like if you like naturally just don't have a good singing voice, and you would have to get like lessons and a bunch of other crap to like actually become a competent singer, that's a lot more work than just being able to. I'm not saying that people aren't lazy, or I don't mean anything like that, but it's uncomfortable. Like, I couldn't do that.
Yeah, it's a different different world for sure.
But all right, so you talked about it a little bit just a little while ago. But how has Digitally Distracted been going since this is? I don't know if you've been on any other podcast, but now that you kind of essentially started your own, how's it been going? Have you been enjoying it?
Yeah, it was sort of an unintentional thing when I first, you know, had sort of sat down and decided I wanted to do this more casual show, because most of my stuff is heavily planned, heavily pre-produced, and heavily scripted. Though some people might say that my on-camera persona doesn't seem scripted. It's just a lot of practice, and you know, I know the material very well, so it may come off as, you know, less scripted. Though I do have some videos that are completely off the cuff. Like, I recently did sort of an action figure memories video where I went through and found all my old action figures. That was obviously unscripted. It was just reacting to finding my old vintage toys and Ghostbusters and Ninja Turtles and all that crazy stuff. But I always wanted to have some platform to have a more casual conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, obviously the first thought is, oh, do a podcast. But because I'm so, you know, built into the YouTube platform, I wanted to make it a video talk show. So basically give it the format of a podcast, but do it in video form. And then, classic me, I couldn't be satisfied with just a two-camera shot. I was like, no, we'll do three-camera shot. And I'll edit the whole thing, you know, because the idea originally was make a show that's much easier for me to put together so that I can release something every week. And I just couldn't let it be. So that's why it became this sort of three-camera shot. And then I brought on my friend Gerald, who I've known for quite a while. And the reason I chose Gerald is because he's someone I've known for a long time. Whenever we get together, it's like we've seen each other every day.
So you have that chemistry already.
All right, right. And we take, you know, we would take long stints without seeing each other. And he's not somebody that I talk to every day. Because I feel like if I had somebody on that I talk to all the time, you know, hours on hours and on each day, we wouldn't have anything else new to talk about. So it's interesting for someone I've known for so long to learn all these new things, like learning that he kept his DVDs in a shoebox instead of in their cases, which made me sick, gutturally sick. So it's like, it's interesting, someone I've known this long, and there's so much that I can learn about them. But also, it's easier to bring things out that I might not think to talk about when I have someone else with me. So that's kind of why in that first episode I referred to him as my second banana, as the co-host, because he really does help me, you know, remember and think of things that I probably wouldn't have thought to have said. And it's doing really well. I expected it to be a very low-viewed show because it is very long. It's different from the content. But there's an audience that's sort of latched onto it. And there's been a huge interest for an audio version because a lot of people like to listen to things like that, you know, on their way to work. And with data plans not being unlimited anymore like they used to be, having a version you can download ahead of time as a podcast is ideal. And just between yesterday and today, the recording of this today, I got all of the approvals for most of the RSS feeds. So Digitally Distracted is now going to be an audio podcast, and I'll be sharing that out probably after we finish up today.
And by the time this episode's released, it's going to have been out for a couple of, at least a week or so. We're recording this, well, about a week or so in advance, but this will probably come out, everyone listening to this, you'll probably be listening to this on August 5th.
The planned release date. Things will have been rolled out.
But that's really cool though, because especially like from what I watched of the Digitally Distracted, now I watched about half of the first episode and I watched about 20 to 30 minutes of your most recent one on Getting Rid of Games.
Right.
And I liked the way you guys kind of bounce off each other, especially because Gerald isn't as into games as you are, so it kind of creates a really, and he's thankfully he's not like against it or anything like that. That would be right. A weird podcast,
right?
But it makes a real cool back and forth where it's someone who's like, you know, has a casual interest in it, but at the same time isn't quite as, you know, he doesn't like to collect and do like do all those other things. I was at a loss for words there for a second. I really like that back and forth that you guys have. I wouldn't have known that you guys don't talk to each other that much, but I guess that's the other nice thing about the podcast. You get to hang out with him a little bit more frequently.
Yeah, absolutely. Cause it would usually go where we would hang out and then I would see him a couple months later, but now we get together almost every week to shoot a couple episodes. And that's kind of why when I was thinking like, who could I, you know, do this with? And he kind of popped in my mind because whenever we are together, our conversations are fairly smooth, and Gerald's very good at making conversation with people. And exactly what you mentioned, the fact that he is not as deeply ingrained in, you know, gaming as well as, you know, just internet culture and YouTube culture, he has a perspective that somebody who was, you know, having the same interests as me, it's more interesting. It does make it different, because otherwise I'm just talking to myself, which could get weird, you know?
No, I mean, if you get a chance to listen to some of my other episodes, you'll hear a lot of them are just me solo, because it's impossible for me to find a permanent co-host on this show. And it's a little frustrating at times, but at the same time, I've gotten pretty good at just, like, talking to myself, as sad as that sounds.
No, some people can pull that off really well. And it is difficult to find somebody who can, you know, for one, be very compatible with the host, and also be able to dedicate the time to it.
Well, I did have one of my best friends used to be on the show. He used to be my co-host, and back when this first started, in fact, the first 7 episodes of this podcast are on SoundCloud, and I got rid of SoundCloud because it was way too expensive for what I was looking to do. And so I brought it over to Libsyn, and I didn't bring it. Maybe I'll re-release those as, like, you know, still loading, retro still loading or something. I don't know. Because those are almost like 5 years old now, those recordings. And, but he used to be on it, and then life got in the way. He moved out. I moved out. Actually, it was really weird because I lived with him for 2 years, and it was still impossible to find time to record with him.
Yeah, it's a time commitment for sure.
But, all right, so I don't really have any good segue for my next question, so I'm just going to kind of roll with it. But, I guess we can go with this. You and Gerald seem to joke around a good chunk on the Digitally Distracted, and my next question is, where do you get your sense of humor from? I find you have a pretty unique one where it's like I said before, it's that Pixar sense of humor where you kind of find that balance, and I just have always enjoyed it. Where do you think you got your sense of humor from?
That is a very difficult question. I'm going to let these motorcycles go by outside my house, and then I'll answer your question. I don't know what's going on out there.
I can ask another one if you want some time to think about it. I got a bunch of questions in the chamber.
I'll go off the cuff. So when it comes to, like, my humor influence, it probably comes from just my family, for one. You know, my mom especially, as I've referenced on Digitally Distracted, Game Joyce, as we refer to her, she was actually really into video games as well, which was always, you know, interesting to see. You know, my mom would play the Game Boy probably as much as I did, though her games that she would play were very specific.
Tetris?
Of course, Tetris. Yeah, but also Dr. Mario. She did
puzzle
she
games.
Beat Dr. Mario on the Game Boy, which is not an easy feat.
No, I had a friend come over recently, and I tried it for the first time. I'll explain a little bit more as to why my video game history isn't as fresh as other people's. But and my friend was playing it, and he was like on level like 9 or 10, and I couldn't get past the second level. I'm like, I don't understand how you can think that fast.
Yeah, and so I would say definitely, you know, my mom is very funny. which is funny because she's a super shy person. She's not outgoing at all. But when it's just the family, she just has this quick wit, and she just can respond to people in just hilarious ways. And then my dad is, we kind of refer to him, he's like a mixture of Mr. Rogers and Owen Wilson, which makes no sense, but combined, he has this sort of weird weird sense of humor that comes off as very, very awkward, and he always busts it out. He's very outgoing, as opposed to my mom, and he'll bust it out at, like, lunch. Like, we, as a family, we still, you know, we obviously don't live at home anymore, but we always get together for lunch on the weekends, the whole family, my brother and his wife and my parents and my grandparents sometimes, and he will just say the most awkward things at the worst possible time around the waitress or waiter or whoever. And I kind of like how awkward his comedy is, which I guess back in our day we called it awkward comedy.
Yeah.
The modern day, the youngins would call it cringe,
yeah,
I
yeah,
guess, no. is the term. Like, you know what? Cringe can be hilarious, honestly.
Oh, my God. I can relate to that. You have no idea how much. My dad is the same way. He's not as outgoing. I mean, our moms are kind of flip-flop. My mom, she has a sense of humor, but she doesn't really tell jokes, if that makes sense. Like, her, like,
yeah, that's exactly that's how my mom is.
It's like, I don't know, like, she'll say something and just laugh hysterically at it, and she sounds like a witch when she does it. It's so awkward, and especially you can hear her from, like, a mile. I love her, but you can hear her from, like, a mile away laughing.
Nice.
And then my dad, for he's the definition of cringe humor. It's crazy, just what you were saying. But, like, for a quick story for what my dad would do, he loved to make us cringe. That was his whole goal in life.
Nice.
And so he, any chance he would get, he would make a joke about having sex with my mom.
Oh, my God.
And in public, too. And the worst one was is that he would start saying, like, hey, honey, let's go do our taxes.
And, oh, my goodness.
And that's what, and so I told that story to a couple friends, and then everyone at work saying, hey, Josh, how's their parents' taxes going? And I'm like, what's wrong with all of you? Are you kidding me?
My parents are the complete opposite when it comes to that. My mom is made so uncomfortable by anything sexual. I remember we were watching a stand-up comedian, and he was talking about, self-pleasure. And as soon as, because she was like laughing up, she thought it was hilarious, and as soon as he started getting into that conversation, she immediately was like, did you guys hear that? I think the oven might be on. And she just bolts out of the room and waits and conveniently comes out as soon as that segment of the stand-up is finished. But she's made so uncomfortable by anything like that. But outside of my family, if I think about like entertainers and celebrities, you know, I grew up in a generation where, you know, the early Jim Carrey, like Jim Carrey was the top dog. Like mm-hmm. he was, you know, Ace Ventura, the original Ace Ventura is one of my favorite movies growing up. Like I used to watch
movie.
That as a kid all the time. So, you know, a lot of that goofiness probably comes from, you know, Jim Carrey. And I was a big fan of Mel Brooks growing up, a lot of Mel Brooks movies.
Yes.
And not just the classics, you know, Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein, but even some of the more obscure ones like Life Stinks was one of my favorite Mel Brooks movies, which is about this rich guy, this rich real estate mogul who sort of wants to own all of these all of this land and sort of rebuild it in his city. I think it's the area where he grew up, and he's just like a billionaire.
Mm-hmm.
And this competing billionaire wants the stuff or wants that area of land. So they make this bet where, you know, the bad guy says, oh, you couldn't last a day down there with the homeless people. And he's like, yes, I could. So they make this ridiculous bet where if he can live amongst the homeless in that area for 30 days and not give up,
mm-hmm.
then he gets the land for free. And if he can't make it the 30 days, like they put an ankle monitor on him, so he has to stay in that area. He can't contact anybody he knows. He has to live like a poor homeless person. It's such a ridiculous premise, but
that is a great. What's this called again?
It's called Life Stinks, and it's just this. It's this odd Mel Brooks film starring Mel Brooks that nobody really talks about. And I assume it's on DVD. It might be one of those weird ones that's still on VHS, but yeah, Life Stinks. It's got to be on DVD at this point. It's Mel Brooks.
I am literally texting it to myself right now, so I don't forget.
Yeah, that was one that I really liked. My parents owned a video rental store when I was a kid.
Really?
So, you know, a mom and pop type shop. And it was the era of VHS and NES and Super Nintendo games on the shelves to be rented. And my parents wouldn't let me take new releases home because those are the money makers.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I was allowed to rent movies whenever I wanted. I could just grab one off the shelf. And I went to the old comedies, so I have this, even though I'm a little bit older, I have this or a little bit younger than I would have been in that era, I love these early 80s comedies and some of the later 80s comedies, but I ended up watching them way too young, like, way too young. Like, I saw Weekend at Bernie's when I was, you know, like, in elementary school or late elementary school. Like, whoops.
Well, I mean, like, if your parents didn't really monitor it, then you kind of lucked out with that.
It's like, I think they were aware. I think they may have just thought I was mature enough. Like, oh, David's mature enough. He can handle it. So, because one of my mom's favorite films is Beetlejuice.
Okay. Tim Burton, why can't I think of his name? Guy from Who Played Batman. I can't.
guy from Who Played Batman. Good old Michael Keaton, yes.
That's the guy.
The best Batman. Fight at me. At me on Twitter. Best Batman, Michael Keaton. But she also loves Michael Keaton. She finds him very attractive, which is odd. Like, I never really thought of Michael Keaton as a sex symbol, but she's like, Michael Keaton's cute. Like, all right. All right, Mom. But, you know, we would watch Beetlejuice together, and it's not really a kid's movie, but it's that weird thing of, you know, these 80s and late 80s movies, everything was like PG back then.
And PG encompassed a lot more back then than it did now.
So we would watch it with, you know, my parents, and my mom would try to mute the scene where he kicks the tree over and says, "Nice effing model." But she would always miss it, and she would accidentally mute "nice" or "model."
So you just, it stands out that much more.
Yeah. Oh, so it made it even more intense. But yeah, so I was like watching Weekend at Bernie's and all these ridiculous 80s comedies. So I feel like a lot of my, I guess you would call it weird style or whatever humor I do have probably comes from that.
No, I get you. I mean, I don't even know. It's like one of those things. If someone asked me that question, I'd have the same kind of response where I'm like, I don't really know how to describe it. I guess I could list a bunch of my favorite movies, like comedy movies, and that's where you can get it from. But
right.
No,
it's not like you sat around and like, where, like, I'm idolizing this specific person's comedy style. Like, it doesn't really work that way, you know?
Yeah. I mean, like, for me, it was... No, I agree with you 100%, because for me, it was my parents. My dad has a really kind of sarcastic and a little bit crude at times sense of humor. My mom is the innocent one. She's the one that like, would laugh if you just said water a weird way. but the other thing I would say for me was Looney Tunes. That was a huge influence on me. I still watch Looney Tunes, like, way more than a grown man probably should, or maybe not as much as a grown man should.
Yeah, either way.
And then I'd say I love Mel Brooks. Oh, cool story, actually. My dad, this was about a year or two ago, my dad got to see Mel Brooks live. He was in Philly, and he showed Blazing Saddles up on the screen and had a Q&A with the audience afterwards.
Wow, that's awesome.
I would have, oh my God, I would have loved to have seen that. I didn't know it was happening, otherwise I would have asked to go with him, but...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I guess my dad didn't think to take me. That's fine, it's cool, whatever. But in any case, all right, so moving on from humor, how do you balance being, because you said before in some of your videos, I guess for those who don't know, by trade you are a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
How do you balance being a teacher and a YouTuber? I feel like especially teaching is it's a lot of work, and being a content creator is also a lot of work. So what do you do to balance and kind of find time to do it all?
Well, I'll say I don't balance it very well. It's very, very difficult. And, you know, that really does show during the school year. And that's why I always do this sort of summer ramp up, because, you know, summer vacation, I'm able to focus on doing, you know, my online web stuff, because it really is more than a full-time job. You might, you know, it is a full-time job doing, you know, videos and shows on the internet, but it's really more than that, because you're always thinking about it.
Mm-hmm.
Even when, you know, the camera stops rolling, you're done the edit, you've posted the video, you're out to dinner, it's still on your mind. You're still thinking about what could I do next? I actually, even last night, I had been thinking about some other ideas of some bigger projects I want to work on, and I just couldn't get to sleep because my mind kept racing about these different ideas I had, and it's sort of the curse of being in, you know, any kind of entertainment medium. You're just always thinking about the next thing, the next game, Dave, you might say. And when I teach, usually during the school year, my goal was always try to get at least two videos a month posted on the channel. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I would maintain that. Sometimes I maybe would get one more extra video done, or sometimes I would only get one video done in a month, depending on what's going on at the school and how much energy I have, because it's very exhausting being a teacher. And it's tricky, because even though, you know, I teach elementary school, so I go in a little bit earlier, I get home a little bit earlier than most 9-to-5ers, but by the time I get home and, you know, I get scripts written and I get cameras and lights set up and audio tested, it's dinner time, so I got to eat dinner, and then, you know, I start shooting at like 8:30 at night when I have to get up the next morning and go back to work. So it's a very hard thing to juggle, which is why this summer was the first time that I've gone really hardcore with a schedule on the channel, posting, you know, 2 videos every week, and also live streaming at least twice a week. And I've actually been live streaming even more than that during the week on Twitch. And it's been great. It's been fun. It reminds me that if I had the opportunity to do this as my only full-time job,
yeah,
I absolutely would jump at the chance to do it. And, of course, a lot of that's going to come down to the numbers, which is unfortunate, that the only way to really make it work is if it's financially viable. So if I ever got to the point where, you know, Game Dave as a, I guess, brand, as you would call it, was making enough income to meet what I made as a teacher, I would likely consider retiring from teaching and just going all in with the Game Dave.
I don't blame you, man. I mean, for me, that's kind of why I podcast. It's because it's honestly 10 times easier than video production. I have one of the easiest jobs in terms of content creation out there, because all of my interviews and episodes are very freeform. I very seldomly script anything.
Mm-hmm.
I go very off the cuff. It's helped me out a lot with... I'm still not good at improv. You know, if you want me to throw me up on a stage, I wouldn't be good at that. But I'm pretty good at just kind of coming up with conversation on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes it super easy, because the hardest thing I have to do is edit out if I say like too many times in an episode.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, it takes up maybe like, and there's another word like, it takes up maybe, if I have a 30-minute episode, it only takes me another 30 minutes to edit it, if that.
Right, just from a listen through.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And that's even if I decide it. A lot of times I just say F it, and I'm like, I don't care. People like the conversation. I want to keep it natural feeling. I don't want to feel like it's scripted. And you can tell when I've done scripted episodes. If some of the episodes I've done before, I did I haven't done another one in a while, but I did a game developer's profile where I did one on Gunpei Yokoi.
Mm-hmm.
And that was fully scripted, because since that's more of a historical, like, informational type of thing more than a review, I kind of wanted to try to compile as much information as I could into that short amount of time, which... it took so long to record because I kept messing up. And then two, it doesn't give you nearly as much content as you think it is when it's scripted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes things different. I actually ramble a lot when I script, so I always think a video is going to be shorter than it ends up being. Like the action figures video, to come back, since that's still fresh in my mind, it's... I was like, oh yeah, it'll probably be, you know, like a 10-minute sort of just overview, and then the first part was 28 minutes, so...
Yeah. There's more parts coming for it?
Yeah, there's a part 2, which will be coming out today, hopefully.
Ooh, I still have to watch the first one, so I will... After work, I'm...
It's carve out some serious time for that one.
It's going to be... the hardest thing is, especially my job doesn't require a lot of overtime, but it heavily encourages it. So I'm always doing like late shifts and stuff like that. And tonight I'm not going to get home till 11 o'clock. So
ooh.
Yeah, it's going to be a late night. I live about an hour away from where I work. So it's a perfect time to listen to podcasts. So
yeah,
I'm hoping to, I'll have to add yours to my rotation.
Yeah.
But all right. So, I guess, I think I had another question based around I can't speak anymore, balancing being a teacher and a YouTuber, but I can't think of them off the top of my head right now.
Okay.
So we'll just kind of move along. So actually, I can tie this in then. So are there any topics in games you wanted to cover but were either too vast or there's not enough information available on them? And especially with the vast portion of it, like I said before, balancing being a teacher and a YouTuber, you just might not have the time that you need to dedicate to specific topics. Is there anything that you've been dying to cover and just haven't been able to?
RPGs, for sure. It's my favorite genre, and I've done very few full-featured reviews on RPGs, aside from Suikoden, which even that, you know, I plan to review the main series in its entirety, 1 through 5, and dedicate a video to each, and I've still not finished Suikoden 2, because it's intense. It is serious business, if you want to do it as definitively as possible, and sort of follow up my first Suikoden review. Suikoden 2 has been in the works for a while, capturing and scripting and deciding what I do want to talk about and what maybe I don't want to talk about. And what always happens is I want to talk about everything, and it's on its way to being like a 30-40 minute video. And it's a lot of like re-scripting and rewriting and reshooting and recapturing footage and getting little weird things that most people wouldn't spend time finding about Suikoden 2. But RPGs in general, I currently have on the Patreon page a sort of RPG review series goal, just to sort of, you know, give me an extra kick in the butt to just bear down and do it, because there are a number of PlayStation 1 JRPGs specifically that just don't get talked about online, and there's some that are just weird in the best ways, and I'd love to do full feature reviews on them, but I know if I started that series where I'm at now, I would get one finished, and it would be months before the next one, and I don't want that series to, get started and then sort of peter out and die and be forgotten about, because these games deserve recognition. So RPG reviews, that's probably something that I would love to have the time to dedicate. For the summer schedule, there's no way I could have pulled that off this summer, but, you know, if Game Day becomes something I can do full time and it's 100% of my focus, I would certainly start to do that. When it comes to obscurities, though, there's been a couple Famicorner episodes that I've wanted to do, and really just import games in general that I've wanted to talk about. I have a few. I don't want to give them away just for just the ridiculousness of them. I'd like it to be sort of a surprise. But there are a couple of, similar to the inflatable motorcycle.
That was an awesome episode.
I have several other very weird, obscure peripherals that have never been covered on the internet. And I've sort of kept them close to the chest, because I have been burned before in sort of sharing some ideas I've had, and they sort of pop up via word of mouth. I'm like, I'll review that now.
I get you completely. I mean, thankfully, I'm a small enough podcast that if I say anything, no one's going to care enough.
Well, hey, I'm here.
Well, no, and that's why I've been so excited to have you on, because you are out of everyone that I've spoken to, and I love all my friends and guests that I've had on, but you actually have some success online with everything. Actually, a good chunk of success. I'm looking at your channel now.
Taste,
you got
just a taste.
But no, that's one of my favorite. That's one of the reasons I've actually kind of gravitated towards your channel, is that you covered different things that were kind of odd. Like, one of my favorite ones recently is your Joy Mech Fight episode in Famicorner.
Yes, that was a really fun one. That's a game I've wanted to review since I started Famicorner. It's just, you know, I wanted to wait until the series got some grounding before I sort of threw it out there, because it's just such a unique game on, you know, the power level that the Famicom had, you know.
It's a beautiful game. It really holds up well.
Yeah, and what was really amazing is that the developer, the programmer, saw the episode.
Really?
Yeah, I didn't believe it at first. I got a Facebook notification, because I have a Facebook page as well where I post the videos and some other little things here and there. And I posted the Joy Mech Fight review, and I don't know if it was via a hashtag or what, but I got a post, and it said, I think it said thank you very much or something like that. And I was like, wait, what?
It was just short and sweet, just a
yeah. I was like, this name looks familiar. And, you know, so because I didn't have to do intense research, I very quickly went back to the Wikipedia page of Joy Mech Fight and checked the, you know, the staff credits. And sure enough, it was the program. It was the same name as the programmer.
That's the robot amazing. Programmer.
So then I go back and I'm like, well, it could just be a coincidence. I mean, what's the possibility that he would find it? So I click on his profile. I check out his history. Find his other social medias, and sure enough, I find his Twitter account, his actual Twitter account, in Japanese, and he had also shared it on his Twitter account. He actually shared the episode out, so he had seen it. So I was like, wow, that is awesome. I guess that's what it's all about. So I replied and said, no, thank you so much for an amazing game, so on and so forth, and he replied to that, and he's like, you're welcome. So he knows enough English to do that. I've seriously considered reaching out to him to possibly interview him about his time, because it seems as if that's the only game he worked on, and he's sort of in technology and robotics and things like that now in his current career.
Okay.
But yeah, because as far as I know, he did the programming of the robots for Joy Mech Fight, but that was a really sort of amazing thing that, you know, the programmer found the episode, and then all these people were like, hey Dave, what great timing, they just announced that Sakupan from or Skapan, as some people say, it appears in the new Smash Brothers Ultimate,
like as a character or just as like
I think it's an assist trophy.
Okay.
And I was like, man, what an obscure thing to pop in, because Smash Brothers Ultimate got announced shortly after that video came out.
Mm-hmm.
And it was people like assumed I knew or something. It's like, no, I had no idea. It's pretty awesome.
You should totally. I mean, he would be a great guest if you can find a translator or something to have on your Digitally Distracted.
That's exactly show at some what point. I was thinking. Is if you know, he obviously can do translation himself, but maybe he has enough English ability that he could do the show. And if not, perhaps I could get in contact with some of my Japanese living friends who might be able to translate for me. Who knows? But it's something I would love to do, just to sort of talk about his time at Nintendo and maybe why it was so short and what it was like working on that game.
I would listen to the hell out of that. That sounds amazing. This wasn't my next question, but this is kind of a better segue than what I had in my head. Speaking of just kind of like, you know, talking to game developers and stuff like that, would you classify yourself as someone who's really interested into, I wouldn't say a game historian, but someone who's very interested in video game history?
Yes, in a way that I wouldn't call myself a gaming historian, but there's things I know, because Norm Caruso already has that title, but
yeah.
a great guy, Norm, good old Norm. Check his channel out that I know all of you have heard of, because he's just killing it lately.
That's where I get a lot of my information from. Either that, or have you ever listened to a podcast called Retronauts?
Yes, I've heard of Retronauts. They did a Suikoden podcast, I think, recently, and I was very, very disappointed that I wasn't asked to be involved. But, yeah, Norm, what's great about him is that he's just so well-researched, and it's not... You know, he doesn't just regurgitate facts. Like, he finds information that no one has found, which is so impressive about his stuff. But I'm definitely an archivalist, and I think when it comes to my collecting, it's not that I want to have everything. It's more that I want to preserve it, and in that weird thing of almost like, it's my own little personal gaming museum, in a way. But as I get older, I'm starting to get to that point where I need to figure out where it ends, because I'm not looking to complete any sets or anything like that. I don't need to have a complete NES collection or anything like that. Though I would take a complete Virtual Boy collection. I would take that.
That wouldn't be that expensive either. So
exactly. Aside from like the really obscure Japanese exclusives, there are a few Japanese exclusive Virtual Boy games
really?
That are insanely expensive. One in particular I've been watching on eBay for quite a while. That's in the thousands, boxed,
God.
But save that for another show.
No, that's awesome, though. That's one of my favorite things about your videos is seeing your game collection in the back, because I fancy myself a little bit of a collector. I don't have nearly the level of things that you have collected.
Ooh, but I don't know if it's worth it. I don't know if it's...
No. Well, I'm not trying to necessarily... I consider myself a budget or a collector on a budget. I can't really afford to drop hundreds of dollars at a time. Like I have definitely have spent more money than I probably should have on my mm-hmm. video games. But for example, Too Many Games is here. I picked up Earthbound, which was the most expensive purchase I've ever gotten at one time.
Right.
But at the same time, I've been trying to get into more of the Famicom and Super Famicom stuff, partially because of your channel. I actually picked up Final Fantasy IV and VI, the Super Famicom versions, complete in box.
Oh, nice. Yeah. And they're not too expensive, which is nice. No. And it's sort of neat to see, you know, what the other world got when it came to Final Fantasy.
Better artwork, that's what they got.
Yeah, it's true. I didn't want to say it, but yes.
No, I love Final Fantasy III's box art. I like how it looks. I like the color scheme they have. It kind of makes it look a little mysterious and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But the artwork for Final Fantasy VI on the Super Famicom is just so, 10 times more gorgeous. I love that art style.
Yeah, it's pretty wild that you go from, you look at the Final Fantasy V cover art, and then you go from that to VI. It's just insane. It's like a different series.
I haven't even seen the Final Five cover art just yet. I only have four and six. So
Final Fantasy Fives is it's cutesy. It's very cutesy. As is I believe four is as well.
Interesting,
isn't it? A little bit. Is it four a little bit?
Four is kind of cutesy. It has all the different heroes kind of lined up and like a chibi, like a 3D-esque mm-hmm. chibi version of them.
Yeah, Final Fantasy Five is very similar. It has Barts or Butts, as he's known in Japan, with his chocobo with him. It's pretty cutesy. And then six is like, whoa, what? Hello, Yoshitaka Amano.
I love that game. The listeners have probably heard this a million times, but just so I said before, I would say what my kind of short video game history is. I didn't get to grow up with the NES or Super Nintendo. I kind of fell into that later on.
Oh, okay.
And so my first console was the N64.
Mm,
and right. I was listening to your Digitally Distracted, and you're talking about how you and Trier, I don't know if that's actually going to happen, but we're talking about how PlayStation versus N64, who would win, knockdown, dragout fight.
Yeah, no, that's we were originally going to shoot that before Too Many Games, because the normal trend is the My Life in Gaming boys usually drive to my place, and they stay at Casa de Game Dave, and then we go to Too Many Games together. We all drive up, because it's only about an hour and a half from my place.
Okay.
And then they usually come back and stay the night. So we usually shoot something or do some sort of collab around that time, but because they had to go to Japan, it's a big deal. they got to go to Japan. They were unable to attend Too Many Games this year, and we were planning to shoot a couple of episodes with Tri and Corey as sort of special guests, and that is one. If and when they visit again, we'll absolutely do that, because I'm in this weird thing of, sure, I could do a sort of Skyped in conversation with somebody, because there's many people I'd love to have on, you know, and give Gerald a break every once in a while, but it's so different when they're in the room.
Mm-hmm.
So any opportunity I have to have a special guest that's in the room in person, I'll jump at that. And of course, Corey and Trier are very likely to be in that situation in the future.
That'd be awesome. I don't think I discovered their channel through yours, but I discovered their channel somewhat recently. Not yours, I actually discovered about a year ago. Actually, the first episode I saw of yours that really got me hooked was your NES Golf one from the Game Dave series.
Ooh, awesome. That is a first. That has never been a video that someone's referenced as their first Game Day video, but I'm glad, because that was a great... I really love that game. Like, that's a classic childhood. That's one that Game Joyce was a huge fan of. She was so good at NES Open Tournament Golf.
As T.O. said.
It's so true.
But no, I loved that episode. But no, I totally lost where the thread of the conversation was going. But we're talking about game history.
Oh yes, game history.
That's where it started.
Yeah, there you go.
This is my favorite kind of podcast, man. I love just you start off with a little bit of form and then you just kind of free flow into whatever. Mm-hmm. With game history, I'm kind of with you on that. Like I wouldn't say I'm a historian per se, though I would love to be. I don't know where to find half the information Norm does. I actually messaged him, like, you know, just on, I forget where, like, Twitter or Skype, not expecting any response, but at least hoping, like, he could point me in, like, the right direction or something, not asking mm-hmm. for him to obviously do that work. Yeah. But I wanted to do an episode, and I have no problem saying this on the air, but I want to do an episode on the history of Namco, because no one ever really talks about them, at least not that I see.
Right, they were hugely involved.
Like, they have a lot, and they still are, I mean, now they're Bandai Namco, but they still have a lot of, like, Tekken and...
Yeah, they've got games coming out all the time.
Yeah, and, I mean, well, they had Pac-Man, right? That mm-hmm. Pac-Man, yeah, Namco, I'm blanking on half of their, like, IPs right now.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
they owned the arcades in, like, the early 80s, late 70s, and all of the 80s and late 70s.
Yeah, especially, the pre-crash arcades, you know?
Mm-hmm. And the only thing, I wanted to find some information on their founder, and the only thing I can find is that what year he graduated college, that he went to college for shipbuilding, and that, which is interesting, but that's not enough to craft an episode around.
That's all the essentials. What are you talking about? You're ready to go.
I'll just have to, he's dead now, but I would have
shipbuilding.
To. Shipbuilding. I'll just do an episode on shipbuilding and something. Yes. I'm really fascinated by that stuff, and it's kind of grown more and more, and thankfully my wife is very patient with me because she's not into this at all. But, all right, so to kind of go on with the topic of games, which this is kind of, it's not a heavy question, but it is a little bit more, you might have to think a little bit on it. Which games have impacted you the most? I'm assuming Suikoden, but...
Absolutely.
What about it has impacted you so much, or like, are there any other games that have impacted you?
Well, that series was probably the first series that made me. Maybe not the first series, but it was the series that made me care the most about the characters. And what was so surprising about that was that there are so many freaking characters in that series, and to still make them stand out amongst themselves was just. It was mind-blowing, because I've always been a fan of games that have a ton of characters. I don't know why, which would be why I'm one of the few that thinks Chrono Cross is better than Chrono Trigger. Oh, put your pitchforks and torches down, Internet, please. But I love Chrono Cross. I love it. And there's so many characters, and you can take these different paths and get... One set of characters if you take this path, one set of characters if you take this path, and if you new game plus it enough, you can combine them and have all the characters at once available for your party. Pretty crazy. But then, you know, nothing compares to Suikoden with the 108 characters per game, which is just insane. I mean, they all can't battle, but they're all involved in the story in some way or another. Some are throwaway characters in a way. You know, you have your merchant characters that just set up shops and... But they're all somewhat unique, and they are uniquely designed, so there is that. But I would say that the death scene in the first game just... It impacted me more than Final Fantasy VII's, and that's when I was like, wow, this 2D sprite-based game has given me more emotional connection than Final Fantasy VII, because there's a lot of crazy crap and intense emotion going on in Final Fantasy VII.
Well, it's just all melodrama. Everything. Like, Cloud is emo kid next to Squall.
Exactly. And Suikoden did it without being, you know, a game that was, you know, done in that emo style. You know what I mean? But I actually, which I'll talk about in my review, Suikoden 2 is the game I played first.
Okay.
And the story of that, I was at a rental store, movie rental store, that was going out of business because sort of that transition between VHS and DVD, that's what killed my parents' video store, because they were like, wow, we're going to have to repurchase every movie on DVD. We can't afford to do that.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah, so we had to close down. And DVDs, when they first came out, were expensive. You know, VHS tapes used to be super expensive. And this other sort of local mom-and-pop video store, it was in another town that we did visit, it was going out of business fairly early, and they were selling everything, including games. And, you know, I got my parents to take me there, and I saw this game. The cover art caught my eye, and it was Suikoden 2. And I was reading it over, and I was like, wow, this sort of medieval fantasy look. You build a headquarters? What? And then I saw 108 Stars of Destiny.
Holy crap.
I was like, oh my god, I'm buying this. And it was super cheap. I mean, at the time, nobody was seeking it out.
Now it's hella expensive.
Yeah, I think it was maybe $10, $20, possibly. And picked it up and fell in love with that game. And that story, the emotional impact that that game has in the very beginning is insane. I mean, you're with your best friend and you get separated and there's just... the drama is done so well, and the villain in Suikoden 2 is just dastardly. You know, people like to say Kefka is like the ultimate crazy villain. This, oh my gosh. No,
puts
no, no,
him
no.
to shame?
I'll tell you. Suikoden 2. Whew. Oh my gosh. It's just... Prince Luca. Oh my god. He's insane. He's referring to townspeople as... you know, soulless pigs and murdering them, you know, execution style in front of their kids. And it's insane that the how much the game is like, hey, we're going to need you to hate this guy really hard.
And real fast. That's insane.
Yeah, so I would say that series just has had the most impact on me. Final Fantasy, of course, is my go-to backup. It's a close battle between the Final Fantasy series and the Suikoden series. For my heart, but Final Fantasy impacted me a lot. Just the stories. I mean, I remember messing around with RPG Maker, if you know RPG Maker, that series.
I do know that.
The PlayStation 1 version of RPG Maker, I can remember the first RPG I tried to make was so inspired by Final Fantasy. I'm sitting there making characters and like, hi, I'm a red mage, I'm a black mage, like very clearly... Final Fantasy, like when it comes to classes, when I think character classes, the first series I think of is Final Fantasy, because to me that's where console RPGs established classes for me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I just love the class systems that the Final Fantasy games have had.
That's interesting, because like for me, I would like RPGs definitely, because I think what drew me to RPGs were the storylines. I guess would you say that was like one of the biggest draws for you? Is because I love, you know, classic platformers and stuff, but they generally don't have good stories.
Right, absolutely. The storylines are what make me love RPGs, because I can ignore crappy gameplay in an RPG if the characters and the story draw me in. I'd be like, yeah, I know this is grindy, or I know this is sort of counterintuitive, this play style, but the story and the characters have got me. Though I'm also sort of a masochist when it comes to grinding. I've been recently going through Octopath Traveler, which is amazing.
I still need to get it. I still need to get it.
Oh, sir, please get it. I know it's been sold out, and I think it's coming back in stock now, finally. Like, that's crazy to think that an old-style, turn-based, 2D, 2.5D, whatever you want to call it, RPG is selling out in this day and age. It's amazing. It's a great time to be alive.
I feel like hopefully this is teaching game developers that, like, I guess we're getting a little philosophical in terms of what makes a good game, but like, I hope it teaches game developers they don't need to have these giant bloated budgeted games, you know? Like,
yeah,
I love AAA titles. Like Uncharted is one of my favorite series. I like Halo, but at the same time, like when you have like, you know, your 80th Call of Duty, you're just kind of like, Are you good now? Are we good?
Yeah, exactly. And teaching them to not ignore classic formulas, because I think for a while it's gotten to the point where, you know, developers think that the classic turn-based JRPG formula doesn't work anymore. And in their mind, like, well, that was just a limit of the hardware back in the day. We couldn't make these expansive open-world RPGs like we can now. Why do we need to go back? Octopath Traveler is a great example of why you should keep that style alive, because people have been itching for it. It's super fun, and just it's brought back so many memories of that classic, you know, those classic gaming moments I had growing up.
And Bravely Default does the same thing, too. I mean, that was a really good one.
Same developers, right?
Mm-hmm. Square Enix, Squeenix.
Bravely Default, Bravely Second, and I think there's another... I think they actually did a Final Fantasy spinoff game. I believe it was one of the DS games. The Heroes of Light, I believe, was them as well before they did Bravely Default.
I actually have that game right here.
Yeah, I believe they did. That was the game they did before Bravely Default.
Okay. Maybe I'll actually give it a shot. The curse of a collector is that I buy so much and I never play anything.
You know what? I hear you, and I'll say streaming has made it easier because whenever I play a game in my free time, I'm like, oh, should this be work? Should this be for Game Dave in some way?
Mm-hmm.
And I feel guilty to play a game for me, and I hate that feeling. And streaming has sort of given me this opportunity to play games that I just want to play, but not feel like it's not wasted time, but that I'm getting more out of it because I'm also sharing it with people, and it's done in a form that can also support the channel. And mm-hmm. Octopath Traveler, like, it's a game I would love to review, but, I mean, everybody's talking about it. I'm not sure what I could bring to the table with an episode dedicated to it. So live streaming it has been a great opportunity to experience it with my audience and talk about it without having to, you know, do a full featured review. Though I'm sure people would like me to do a review of that game. I just don't know if there will be time. You know, RPG reviews are intense.
I believe, and it makes sense too. I mean, I feel like the hardest thing, at least for me as a content creator, is finding the next topic to choose. And you don't want to do something that everyone else is doing, but at the same time, it's how you get views or listens in my case.
Oh, yeah. If I had done a...
Fortnite.
Oh, gosh. Game Dave reacts to the announcement of Octopath Traveler. You know, I could have done that. You know, it's not off the table. Maybe I will. The action figure video was kind of like a test to see how well-received an off-the-cuff sort of video, though it's a little more produced than what I would normally do. There is a second camera. My good friend Noptop was in town, mm-hmm. Fellow YouTuber and filmmaker, and he was nice enough to shoot sort of a handheld secondary camera for that, so he got close-ups of the figures while I spoke to them to the wide camera. Typically, that's not what I would do, but I have toyed with the idea of doing more casual, just conversational videos where, you know, there's a topic I want to talk about. Maybe not news necessarily because I'm not really interested in, you know, regurgitating news to my audience. But if they're like, actually, I'll give you a little sneak preview. The video that will be coming out hopefully next week after the second part of the action figure extravaganza is going to be sort of a discussion about Amazon Japan and how it's really not that difficult to create a Japanese Amazon Japan account and purchase items that are only available on Amazon Japan, because recently they had the Famicom, you know, the NES Classic had its re-release, so mm-hmm. people can actually purchase them very easily, which is amazing. Thank you, Nintendo. Papa bless. And you know, the Famicom Classic has also had a re-release and is much easier to purchase on Amazon Japan. So you don't need to go to eBay and pay $100 when you can get the Famicom Classic for $55 or $60 on Amazon Japan with fairly affordable shipping. But the reason that I went to Amazon Japan is they announced the Shonen Jump Gold Famicom Classic. I'm not sure if you've seen that.
I think... I did hear about it. I don't remember much about it, but I did hear about it.
Yeah, so it has a different set of games, and it's sort of this Shonen Jump collaboration, and who doesn't want to have a golden Famicom Classic? I mean, I do Famicorner. I've got to have one, right?
Seriously.
So Amazon Japan, I was like, wonder if they'll have them. Sure enough, in stock the day that they were released, not too expensive. So I ended up picking up all the Japanese classics. So I got a Famicom Classic, a Super Famicom Classic, and the Shonen Jump Gold Famicom Classic. And I just want to talk about how easy it was to go on Amazon Japan, make an account, check out, use your normal North American credit card setup, and yeah, you have to pay shipping. There's no free Prime shipping when you have an international purchase.
Yeah, yeah.
But it ships via DHL.
I hate that service.
Which can be a pain, yeah. But with Amazon Japan, I will say it's very quick.
That's good.
They text you, and they'll say, hey, is it okay to schedule your drop-off? You don't have to sign.
Hmm.
If you go in and say, just leave at the front door, and you sign off digitally, you don't have to worry about being at your house, which is why a lot of people don't like DHL. But and I think within 2 or 3 days, everything arrived from Osaka.
Wow.
Yeah. So I'm going to do a video just briefly talking about the Japanese classics, but mostly talking about how it's not that difficult to use Amazon Japan, and you can import a lot of unique things through Amazon Japan much more affordably than buying them from a Japanese seller on eBay, where they're going to charge you out the butthole in shipping, because you can buy a box Famicom game for $10 on eBay from Japan, and it's going to ship for like $30.
Oh, wow.
And a lot of Japanese sellers make their money on shipping outside Japan, which is kind of crazy. So it's a video that's down the road, and I'm sure I'll do a Famicorner special episode where I actually do talk about the consoles in depth and review them. That's something down the road as well. You heard it here first, everybody.
It's a still loading exclusive.
Exclusive.
All right, so, oh my god, there's just so much I like. This has been awesome so far. I still have a good chunk of more questions. Do you still have some time? Are you still good for a little while?
You know what? No. Yes, we'll do it. We'll go a little longer. Let's do it for you, Josh. We'll do it.
Oh, thank you, sir. Thank you. All right. So then I will, because I still have a good chunk left. So I'll just condense down those questions.
Sure.
So all right. So since we have been talking about buying games and collecting and stuff like that, what are some of your favorite items in your collection? Like, what are some of your prize jewels? Gems, whatever.
my prize family jewels over here. Definitely, I mean, come on. I keep saying it. They're going to get tired of hearing it. Suikoden, of course, 2 specifically because it is so stupidly expensive. That series, those are my gems. I'm sort of looking at my collection now. My WonderSwan collection is pretty cool. Not the games themselves. There's not a lot of games I have for the WonderSwan, but my actual WonderSwan console collection is sort of prized in a way. I have the Final Fantasy branded limited edition WonderSwan.
I saw those on eBay. I was tempted to buy them.
Yeah, I have one which is like new, and then I have the Final Fantasy II WonderSwan branded limited edition console set, and that one is sealed. It's never been opened.
That's amazing.
And that's pretty awesome. And then I also have a Swan Crystal in the box, which has never been opened, which is the coveted best WonderSwan screen you can get. So that's pretty exciting. The old Swan Crystal, of course, coming back to old Gunpei, our boy Gunpei Yokoi.
R.I.P.
Yeah.
All right, so sorry, I'm at a loss for words right now. It's been I'm a little tired. I'm not a morning person, even though we're approaching noon. But I would guess for me, my prize, other than I have a copy of Earthbound, not complete in box. There's no way I could afford that unless I lucked into that. I have a copy of a game called Scat for the NES.
Mm-hmm.
You ever heard of it?
Yeah, that one's a little pricey, isn't it?
Yeah, I got it complete in box. I lucked into it. So the listeners have heard this a million times, so I apologize in advance, listeners. But the whole 40 for 40 series I've been doing on the 40 NES games, they're all complete in box.
Okay.
I got them from this one woman that I used to work with. She had a box of 32 complete in the box NES games. I just found the other 8. And she's like, how much do you think they're worth? Because she knew I was into it. And I didn't want to, you know, screw her over because I actually do know her. If it was like just some person at a yard sale, I'm like, oh, $2 a piece.
Yeah.
But I told her, I'm like, you could easily get these for over $1,000 on eBay. Like, but you have to do all the shipping. You have to do all that extra stuff for a store. If you like trade it off to a store, you can, you know, get it for, you know, $600 to $700 because they have to make a profit.
Right.
And for me, I'm like, I can pay you $250 in cash for all 32 of these. And she said, yeah, sure, why not?
Wow.
So on average, I paid about $7.30 a piece for these. I got Scat complete in the box, Mega Man 3 complete in the box, Mario Brothers 2 and 3, Conquest of the Crystal Palace. What else did I get? There's a lot. I'm looking at them all now, but it's at a weird angle, so I can't really read it.
That's great. That's great.
Punisher, a bunch of awesome games, all for essentially $7 a piece.
That's amazing. I'll tell you, that's you know, some people get embarrassed about their collecting, but I'll say mentioning it at work is great, because there's so many people at work that might have just their kids' stuff. Like, you know, as a teacher, I work with, you know, some older women, you know, whose kids have grown up and moved out, and you know, sometimes things get shoved in the attic. I'm like, oh wait, you want those old games? Oh, let me see if I have them. I've gotten boxes of things given to me at work before, just given to me. Our nurse, our awesome nurse, I just gotta say it, this is not the platform for it, but we have the best school nurse ever. Not just because she gave me stuff, but one day she came down, she's like, hey, I have this old game system, do you want it? I was like, sure, whatever it is, sure. So she brought it in, it was like one of the original Pong consoles.
What?
I was like, oh, okay. She's like, let me know if it works. I was like, I'll let you know. It's the classic peg where you have to screw down on the clips. So I gotta bust out an older TV to test that out. And then the next week, she was like, hey, I found her old Atari here, and it's like in mint condition. So she brought her old Atari 2600, which, you know, not that those are being seeked out or anything.
Yeah, that their time has passed now.
Yeah, our old phys ed teacher gave me his old PS1 and PS2 collection. Nothing too crazy. He was obviously into the sports games, so
yeah.
It's a lot of excess trash garbage, but still nice of him to give them. And then another friend of mine had a friend who had all of his childhood game collection he wanted to get rid of. And he's like, are you interested? I was like, oh, of course. Like, what does he have? And he's like, I think he has like a Super Nintendo and maybe some games and stuff. So he's like, are you interested? I said, absolutely. So he texted his buddy, and his buddy sent some pictures, and he sent me the pictures, and then I saw an NES, and there was a Super Nintendo. It was like one of those the shorter in height clear Rubbermaid containers. So it's probably like a 6-inch tall one. Nothing too crazy. I could see a Super Nintendo in there. I could see, I could see Super Mario RPG, which is, you know, a semi-expensive game. And then just some like very common titles that you would see with a Super Nintendo, like Super Mario World, so on and so forth. And a couple NES games, nothing crazy. Maybe Contra was in there.
That's still pretty valuable now, at least. That's like a $30, $40 cart.
Yeah, this was a little bit before that, but it's crazy how Contra's gone up in price, because, like, what a common game to be $30.
I mean, the Final Fantasy games aren't that, like, rare or anything. They're just highly sought after.
Yeah. I mean, luckily the PS1 Final Fantasies are very affordable, which is nice. So anyway, he's like, the guy's just trying to get rid of the stuff. Do you have any offer? And I was like, I don't really know. I said $100. Because I was like, I get, you know, an NES, a Super Nintendo. They look like they needed to be cleaned. And, you know, at most, hey, I got Super Mario RPG, which is a fairly expensive game. And it was in the box. And I didn't have a boxed copy of Super Mario RPG. I only had a loose copy. So at the very least, I was like, yeah, I'll pay $100, get a console or two, bonus, and Super Mario RPG. Text his friend. Friend says, sure thing. It was my coworker, actually, who got back up with me later and said, hey, I got the stuff today. Let me know when you want to come by and pick it up. And I was like, okay, I'll come by tonight. So I came by that night. It's the first time I've ever told this story. So I pull up, and my buddy, my coworker, has already got his car, his Jeep, or I don't know, I think it was his Jeep, or his it was his Nissan Rogue. Had his Nissan Rogue opened up. The trunk was opened up, the hatchback. And I don't see that clear Rubbermaid container. I see a big, you know, full-size Rubbermaid container. I was like, oh, okay, so maybe there was a couple more things. Maybe he moved them into this other container. And as I pull up and park my car, I see him pull it down, very, very, very much struggling, places it down, and behind it is another full-size Rubbermaid container. That is the clear Rubbermaid container. And then behind that, another giant blue Rubbermaid container.
And they were filled?
Yes. And I'm like, what? Where's the, what are you talking about? He's like, oh, it was a lot more. He had a bunch of other stuff too. He just didn't send the pictures for it. And I was like, he still only wanted $100? He's like, yeah, he didn't really, he just wanted to get rid of it. And he wanted to make sure it went to somebody who would take care of it. And I told him about your channel and that you're a collector and you're not just going to resell the stuff. I was like, oh, okay. So I open it up. One of the bins is just his entire childhood collection of Nintendo Power magazines.
Oh.
The other box had two Super Nintendos, two Nintendo consoles, tons of box Super Nintendo games and NES games and controllers. And, it was insane. It took me a week to sort and clean and organize. There was N64 games. There was the special edition, the limited edition gold Zelda N64 games.
Oh, wow.
It was outrageous. And I told him that, I was like, ask your friend if he wants more money, what I could do. And he was like, no, it's totally cool. And the friend watches my channel now. And it was just, that was the most insane haul I've ever had. And it was so good, I felt bad about it.
That's amazing. Like, that is seriously one of the coolest stories I've ever heard of, like, a find like that.
Dude, it was insane. And he was totally cool with it. He just wanted it to go to a good home, and it's certainly being well cared for here.
I mean, that's the thing I found. I go game hunting at yard sales every now and then, but it's, you know, it's a lot of work, a lot of gas.
Yeah, and it's slim pickings, too.
Yeah. Though, I still have to, I need to follow up with the guy, but I might have found a guy who has an Intellivision, so I'm,
ooh, nice.
I don't know how much he wants for it, but he seems to know the value of it because he works at, an auction type of place, but mm-hmm. at the same time, he kind of just wants to get rid of it, so.
Right.
And I found, what else did I buy from that guy? Oh, I probably paid a little bit too much, but some of his relatives had a bunch of Xbox 360 and Game Boy Advance games that they didn't want. I paid $20 for it.
Oh, nice!
I got 30 games for it. It was a good deal. I could have probably gone less, but because the guy looks surprised when I'm $20, he goes, "What, really, for this crap?" I'm like, sure.
Yeah, I mean, so to some people, if they don't have a connection to it and they don't value it the way we do, it's more just clutter that they would easily drop off at Goodwill, you know.
I lucked into it. I got Pokemon Pearl out of it, the DS game.
Nice.
Part of Pokemon Pearl, a couple Kirby games. It was a good time. But no, you're right, though. If they don't value it, it means nothing. And it's funny. That's why I don't quite understand someone who's willing to drop, fuck you levels of money on collecting, because it really just doesn't make a whole lot of sense, because there's no guarantee this market is going to be here in 30 years.
Yeah, it's very rare that I'll go crazy. I mean, I'm pretty frugal with my collecting. I try to make sure I get things at an affordable price, unless mm-hmm. it's something that, you know, obviously, you know, with Earthbound, it's kind of one of those things where even if the market crashes on old school gaming, it's not going to bottom out. You know, it's not going to be $20 for Suikoden 2. Like, is that ever going to happen? I doubt it.
Oh, and it's in a weird way, it's kind of weird how the game fandom works, where it's I guess it's the same thing with almost everyone in American culture. You know, the youth are looked down upon for not knowing as much. So I almost wonder if younger kids would almost feel left out, because they're like, well, I didn't grow up with the NES, so. And these older people are just like, well, you don't know what it was like back in my day, having to, you know, no mm-hmm. save features and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
But at the same time, if you really want to keep value in your collection, you kind of need to cultivate that relationship. You kind of need to show them how awesome these old games are, so they will have value to, they will put value to it themselves, and hopefully, still be, you know, in 20 years when they have their own disposable income and whatnot, they can then be like, oh no, these NES games are still actually pretty cool. I'd still buy these.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would always tell somebody that is thinking about buying a game that may be expensive, I would say never buy something with the intention to sell it. Mm-hmm. Because then you're just going to burn yourself. But if you're comfortable buying something and paying that price, and you know you're always going to keep it, then hey, go for it.
That's a really good philosophy to kind of take, or not kind of, but just adhere to. Because
if you're thinking, ooh, if I pay this much, well, I mean, I can always resell it. If you're thinking that way, then it's not that important.
You don't know what it's going to be worth in like 5-10 years. Hell, even look at how Atari bottomed out. Atari collecting used to be huge, you know, like 10-15 years ago. And
ooh, yeah, it's nothing. I don't know if the NES will ever hit it that hard, because there's just something so iconic about NES, and
I agree.
So much of the NES, in even just in character, has lived on. I mean, it's Mario's beginnings in a real way.
Well, that and Mario is still around. It's not like, like when you look at the only character I can think of from the Atari generation that's still kind of has some kind of swing or like sway in this in today is Pac-Man, and even he doesn't carry the same level of like reverence. I don't know if that's the right word, but you know, he doesn't
and
carry
certainly
the same
not
level.
And certainly isn't assumed, like most people probably wouldn't even think Atari when they think of Pac-Man.
No, they probably wouldn't. They just think of Pac-Man or Namco. Exactly. I agree with you that the NES will probably hold up a lot longer, if not forever, than the Atari did, because Atari games don't really have a storyline. They're still very arcadey, but the NES, I mean, Final Fantasy started out on it. Like, Mega Man has a storyline. Hell, even Mario has a really, like, basic storyline that you can, like, sink your teeth into.
Yeah.
And, yeah, no, I agree. I think it's gonna, especially because, NES games are much more advanced than people give them credit for.
Yeah, they were doing some pretty incredible things with that hardware.
I still love, when I talk to people about like video game history, I always say like, well, think of it this way. One of your favorite games now, like Grand Theft Auto, it has a whole day and night cycle and things change as the day goes on, right? And they say, yeah, I'm like, look at Castlevania 2, Simon's Quest. And that had a full day and night cycle, which, when I first, you know, like I said, I didn't grow up with it, but when I kind of discovered it retroactively, it blew my mind. I thought that was the coolest thing, that a game from, you know, 1987 or whatever, I think that was the year it came out, I don't know, did something like that. That's a really advanced gameplay mechanic that you wouldn't expect to show in an NES game.
A horrible night for a curse.
All right, so I only got, let me see, two more questions for you, and we can wrap this up. So,
sure.
First one, have you ever had any awkward or weird fan interactions that you'd be willing to share? I don't know if there's anything that you want to share, but figured that's always an interesting story for me to hear.
Let me think. Awkward? Not really, which is awesome. I've been lucky enough to not have any weird or awkward fan interactions. I mean, maybe the most awkward one would be, somebody was with their family and they wanted to get a picture, but they couldn't figure out how to get the camera to work on their phone, which was a little awkward. There's a lot of standing around. I was like, oh, all right. And they were very apologetic. Like, oh, I'm so sorry about this. Like, it's fine. It's fine. But no, not really. It's been, I've said this before too, in other situations where, the great thing about going to conventions is it makes those numbers real and really makes everything concrete and makes it matter so much more. Even just, like, say you've got 10,000, 20,000 views on a video that you posted, and it's like, wow, yeah, that's great. It's doing really well. But then you go to a convention and you meet just 10 people that saw your videos. It makes it matter way more than those views do, you know?
I agree.
And it's amazing.
I only, like I said, I'm a pretty small podcast, but I actually have met people just out in the wild, for lack of a better phrase, but out there, out in the world, just saying, oh yeah, I actually listened to your show. And I personally can't believe it, because I have such a small listener base, which they're all awesome people. In fact, doesn't make any sense of a segue, but one of the fans, his name's Dylan, he actually... you were talking about how hard it is for you to review RPGs. He's the first person to actually give me a recommendation of a game to play. He wants me to do the original Final Fantasy.
Oh, nice. Yeah, it's a little dated, But if you want to go hardcore, that's the way. I mean, you could play the Final Fantasy Origins port.
On the GBA, right?
Yeah, there was that, and there was also on the PS1, that was the first version of the port that I played. And it does have a mode that makes what's most annoying, I think, about Final Fantasy on NES is the level up screen. You almost get pissed when you level up because it takes so long, because it will go through each character and say, you know, whoever, Dave leveled up, strength up, defense up.
It's and that you have
to
go slow. Through
each. Oh, it's super rough. Whereas the, you know, the modified port, it goes a lot quicker. So, and FF1 is very grindy. You have to grind, but that was just the nature of
that's an old
NES
RPG.
RPGs. Yeah, I mean, Dragon Warrior, same way. You got to grind. Ultima Exodus, you got to grind, you know?
That's one of the games I have coming up on my 4440 series, Ultima Exodus.
There you go. That was one I had as from my childhood, and I really liked it. That was my first Ultima game, and then I went back much later, and I was like, wait, this was a PC series? And I was like, so interesting. If it was the Ultima collection on PC, and it was like a collection of, I think, a Calibeth, Zero, all the way through, I think, Ultima 8.
I've been meaning to try Ultima 4. I remember Retronauts did an episode on it, and it interested me that the whole purpose of the game is about your, like, karma, I guess, for lack of a better word. It's, you know, it's about your moral standings, your moral compass, and that really determines it. I thought that was really interesting.
A huge part of the Ultima series is this sort of pseudo-religion that's based around morality, and it's very funny to see in the Ultima games how they purposely show that people can distort understandings of religion and morality and mistranslate things for their own, you know, it's like, oh no, these are the ones who are the good guys. They follow God and they follow the virtues. And then you see how they can be distorted by, you know,
by one.
If you want to get biblical about it, you know, how easy it is to see Pharisees. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. It's kind of like I still haven't finished it, but Final Fantasy Tactics. That storyline is a lot like that.
Oh my! One of my favorite. That was my first ever tactics strategy role playing game experiences, and I love Final Fantasy Tactics, the original on PlayStation. Oh man, love it.
I'm playing through it. Well, I've taken like a 3-month hiatus because when I was playing it, I think I stopped a couple weeks before my wedding because I just got married this year.
Okay.
And after that, I just haven't had a chance to. I've been just playing other things just because it took me a while to get used to it. But I remember Ramses? Yeah, Ramses is the main character.
Yeah, Ramza or Ramza.
Ramza,
I used
sorry,
to say
Ramza.
I always said Ramza as a kid. It probably is Ramza. It's just that classic American trying to pronounce Japanese written stuff or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Ramza's the main character. I cannot. Oh, Weigart. He used to be part of. I just beat that boss fight.
Okay.
And the way I did it was, you know how there's like that one-on-one section where you have to. It's just you and Weigart, or how you pronounce his name, and then he transforms and you fight him as well as some other monsters.
Yes.
My friend told me about this, but there's a way that you can not glitch it, but like kind of cheat the AI in it, where you can be on one end of the map and he'll be on the other, and as long as you keep moving left and right, he'll only follow you left and right and never close the gap. So what I would do is I would just constantly accumulate and shout or yell. I did it so many times and leveled up so many times that I was able to hit him 8 times in a row before he could make any move at all.
Oh, that's awesome. That's what I love about FF Tactics. There's so many little things in the gameplay system that you can sort of, you know, distort and learn about and just discover all sorts of weird ways that the AI responds to things. Mm. And just the job class system, as I've said, I love classes. And you know, I still have my memory cards with all of my original RPG saves, and my Final Fantasy Tactics save is insane. Like, it's sad, the hours I put into tactics.
Nah, it's never, as long as you enjoyed it, it's not sad. That's my opinion.
What I did, I like and hate the fact that the random encounters in Final Fantasy Tactics level up with you. The boss fights and chapter-based story battles do not. So if you get insanely grindy in Final Fantasy Tactics, the end battle is a joke, an absolute joke, because only the random encounters level up with you.
That's why I'm stuck, is because I leveled up so much in that Weigart fight, the random encounters are impossible because all the other characters are so far, or so much a lower level.
Yeah, yeah.
Though, I'm going to try taking Ramza out and just playing with those characters and see
if I wonder if it will level down. It might level down for you.
That's what I'm trying.
I'll tell you, man, the freaking red chocobos on one of the waterfall random encounter stages, chocobos are nasty. When you over-level, they will destroy you. They're I don't demons. Remember the name of the exact encounter, but it has a waterfall hill, and I remember, like, I would just pray, I would save, and then move on the map and hope I didn't initiate that random encounter because they would crush you because they just leveled up with you so insanely.
It's awful. It's absolutely awful.
It's a love-hate. It's a love-hate.
All right, so final question to wrap all of this up. It's a big one, all right?
Okay.
When did the great Jackie Chan come into your life?
Oh, sweet, sweet tender Jack.
That is literally the moment I realized that you're one of my favorite YouTubers is when you included the police story theme on one of your episodes. I am a huge martial arts movie junkie, and Jackie Chan's like one of my favorites. And when I saw that, I'm like, oh my god, someone else knows about this.
Well, you'll enjoy. There's a little treat for you then in the action figures episode, because it sort of opens up with me talking about a recent trip to an action figure store and a short Goodwill trip. And in the VHS section, there were some Jackie Chan VHS tapes, so I dropped in a little classic Jackie Chan music in the background, which you'll appreciate. It goes way back to Blockbuster, I believe. And I remember seeing, I was starting to get back into martial arts again, and I was getting into martial arts films a little bit, and I believe it was when Legend of Drunken Master released, which is technically Drunken Master 2, and I remember seeing this wall, and the cover art at the time, VHS era, was him punching through a white background, which is not even a still from
the movie.
I'm pretty sure for the longest time, every Jackie Chan movie just cut out him in his black t-shirt from Rumble in the Bronx and put it on every box of him punching. Every time you see Jackie Chan making that face punching, it's the Rumble in the Bronx photo.
That makes so much sense. I never even thought of that.
Yeah, all the time. Because Legend of Drunken Master is not a modern day film.
Not in the slightest. He's got
a black t-shirt on, and it's like...
That's fantastic.
Yeah, so that was... I think that was the first movie I ever saw. I was like, this is amazing. And then it was... After that, anytime I saw Jackie Chan, I rented it. So it was Mr. Nice Guy was one of the early ones. Rumble in the Bronx, insane. I went back and saw the original Drunken Master afterwards, realizing that Legend of Drunken Master is Drunken Master 2, technically. And then Project A and Project A2, Operation Condor, and Operation Condor 2, which is also a crazy story where they released Project A as in reverse order over here. So if you watch them in order, you're actually watching the sequel first.
Why do they do that? I don't understand. I don't
know how they messed it up. Because they do that with Operation Condor, I think, as well. Because there's Operation Condor and then Armor of God, I believe, is the subtitle. But it's just crazy. And so then I was just on this. I was obsessed. And that's what got me interested in Chinese martial arts. Because I had always been interested in the Japanese martial arts and karate. Karate. And then once I got into Jackie Chan, that's when I was like, ooh, kung fu is the best martial art. And that's what led me to kung fu.
I think for me, what drew me to Jackie Chan was his choreography. His fight choreography, I still think, is better than almost anyone's I've ever seen.
Oh, hands down. There, no, you can't compete. And even people that can compete, a lot of times they're not even, it's not even them in the fight scenes, you know. Now, mm-hmm. Donnie Yen is pretty good. I'll give you that. Donnie Yen is a solid martial artist. He impresses me a lot, though his movies aren't as fun as Jackie Chan's, because Jackie Chan was doing the crazy stunts, you know.
I 100% agree, and I love Donnie Yen. I think he's one of my favorite more modern ones, but even Same. So regardless of the skill level of the martial artists themselves, it doesn't matter much on screen if you aren't good at choreographing.
Exactly. And that's when the whole debate about who's better, Jackie Chan or Jet Li, I'm like, Jackie Chan every time.
Yeah,
Jet Li is a trained professional martial artist, yes, but Jackie Chan's fight scenes hands down are better, significantly better.
Now, who would win in a fight? I don't know. I'm not debating that. I'm with you. Based off their movies.
Who would be more fun to watch in that fight? Jackie Chan.
Oh, my God, yeah. Have you ever seen, unfortunately, the channel's defunct now, but there's a channel called Every Frame a Painting. Have you ever heard of that channel on YouTube?
I don't think so.
After we're done recording, I'm going to link you a video. It's fairly short. It's like 8-9 minutes. And it's this guy, you would love it, especially since you started with this whole, you know, the whole Game Dave experiment with, not experiment, I'm sorry, that makes it sound condescending. I didn't mean it like that. The whole Game Dave channel with, you know, a love for making videos and movies and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. This channel is a really serious, like, dive into, like, film and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And he breaks down why Jackie Chan's fight scenes, at least in his opinion, are so well done and so good.
I probably have seen that video, just didn't know the name of the channel. But yeah, definitely link that to me. I would love to watch that.
And well, the rest of his stuff, he has, like, he does videos on, for example, Edgar Wright, how to do visual comedy, stuff like that. So
That does sound familiar.
He'll break down a specific director's or actors or somebody's work and explain, you know, this is why they're so iconic. Watch and he'll break it down frame by frame so you can see stuff like that. It's really good. It's a really good channel.
Yeah.
But in any case, all right. So that about wraps it up for all the questions that I had. I don't know, Dave. Do you have did you enjoy yourself? I hope this was a good time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it was good. Nice casual conversation. That's what I'm all about.
So, is there anything you? I'm assuming there's a lot you would like to promote your channel. Plug away. What do you got?
All right. So, I guess the easiest way would be to just go to gamedave.com, which will take you straight to the YouTube channel, or you know, youtube.com/gamedave, facebook.com/gamedave. Pretty much everything is Game Dave. I've been streaming on Twitch, so you can find me on Twitch, twitch.tv/GameDave. The only thing that really isn't Game Dave is the Twitter handle, which is NextGameDave. But you search Game Dave, and I'm sure I'll pop up at some point. But yeah, I've got the YouTube channel. I stream on Twitch. I also stream on YouTube. And Twitter is probably the best social media to follow me on. That's the one I'm most active on.
All right. And as usual, guys, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, @StillLoadingPod on all of them. Some quick shout-outs to some of my favorite shows. My original podcasting partner in crime, Erica from The Apex and the Abyss. If you guys like true crime podcasts, go give her a listen. You can also check out Two Guys in a Game and The Hotter Show. Huge supporters of mine, have been for a while now. Go give them some love. No Geeks Allowed. Actually know those guys personally. Hung out with them at too many games. Go give them a shout out. That's KNOW, No Geeks Allowed. And Christian and Damon's Amazing Nerd Show, Drinks with Larry, all great podcasts. And I think that should wrap it up. So once again, Dave, thank you for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
And we are hopefully to have you back, and we will see you all next time.